I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, Mark won up for Donald Rumsfeld, and I don't mean a victory. The defense secretary was among the first to say yesterday that the war for Iraq is not over. Sure enough, there is ongoing gunfire in Baghdad today and continued uncertainty to the south. The northern city of Kirkuk is now in Kurdish hands. The fate of Mosul is less certain. But the challenges for whatever administration replaces Saddam Hussein are already starting to mount. First question, who's in charge? Is it to be a retired U.S. general or a parachute team of exiles, the self-named Free Iraqis? More questions. Who will police the country? How much independence will each of the ethnic and geographical areas be allowed? And who's going to pay to fix everything that's broken? It is a long list of questions, and the short list of answers proves what most analysts have been warning, that while winning the war may be easy, winning the peace will certainly not be so easy. Connection listeners, we're looking ahead at the difficult issues of occupation. Is the U.S. administration ready for what's ahead? Are you ready for the commitment of cash and the years it may take to rebuild, reconstruct, and reconstitute Iraq? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And here to talk with us about the occupation and reconstruction is Bathsheba Crocker. She's the author of a report called Post-War Iraq, Are We Ready? Bathsheba is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a former advisor to the U.S. Department of State. She's at an NPR studio in New York. Welcome to The Connection, Bathsheba.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And also with us this hour, Sandra Mackey, longtime Middle East correspondent, author of The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. She's at a public radio station in Atlanta. And Sandra, it's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
I thought that we'd begin by listening to something that is being broadcast today on Iraqi television. This is apparently an address by President George Bush, taped a couple of days ago. And we've seen just flickers of it already on television. The screen shows the president's face with Arabic script below. Let's listen together to what the U.S. president is saying to Iraqis.
We will help you build a peaceful and representative government that protects the rights of all citizens. And then our military forces will leave. Iraq will go forward as a unified, independent, and sovereign nation that has regained a respected place in the world.
Now, President Bush, broadcasting this tape message on Iraqi television today, is also anxious to deliver that message of freedom.
Your country will no longer be held captive to the will of a cruel dictator. You will be free, free to build a better life instead of building more palaces for Saddam and his sons, free to pursue economic prosperity without the hardship of economic sanctions, free to join in the political affairs of Iraq.
Now, Bathsheba, maybe I can start with you. It's not clear to us how many Iraqis will actually hear or see the president because of the state of Iraqi television and radio sort of up in the air. But this is obviously something that was planned in advance, something that was set in motion in anticipation of this moment. How well prepared is the United States for the rest of what lies ahead?
Well, it's a good question, and I think it's a bit of a mixed answer. There are people in place who have begun moving into the country to sort of do the U.S. side of the civil administration in the immediate post-war period, but the situation is still not stable enough for them to really start moving throughout the country. And until we declare victory, Tommy Franks is not formally in control. So in the moment, we have a little bit of a power vacuum. I think the plan is for this U.S. contingent of about 230 people eventually to get throughout the country and to work under the command of a retired Army general named Jay Garner, who will be reporting to Tommy Franks, at least in the interim, and then to start working with some Iraqis. But the plan has not been, it's only just beginning to be described. So we saw a report in the LA Times this morning about Secretary Powell's statements on this issue yesterday, and the Financial Times reported a little bit, but the administration has not been very clear about the actual plan so far.
And Sandra, help us with an understanding of timing here, because if we just wind the clock back a week or so, we can list off southern Iraqi cities which were in effect, had the Ba'ath Party moved out, call it liberated, call it occupied. But these people still don't have any kind of civil administration. How long can that vacuum remain before it causes real problems?
A very short time because of the already fractured nature of Iraqi society. And you have a situation in which people are historically divided into ethnic and sectarian groups. They are divided between people who have the attitudes of the city and those who have attitudes of the country. And most importantly, I think that you also are dealing with a social system in which tribes are still very, very important. And this is a very complex demographic map to have to come up with some way of governing these people. I mean, just simply saying we're going to have a democracy is too simplistic, and it simply is not going to work. There's going to have to be a special suit of democracy made for Iraq, and no one has come up with that plan yet.
Well, let me ask you about a specific example. I was reading today about confusion in Basra, the British saying, well, we'll get this particular cleric to help us choose who the civilian leader should be, and then doctors telling the reporter, medical doctors, oh my gosh, you can't choose that cleric. He was in bed with Saddam. You need to go to this person. Should these decisions have been made in advance, or even in fairness to the administration, could they have been made in advance?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. The administration, in my opinion, really didn't give enough attention to the fallout of the victory. And, we're really seeing that right now, as you mentioned. The other point is, though, that, it's very hard to plan these things in advance because, you don't know what the situation is going to be on the ground. And Saddam Hussein ran such a complex political system that it was very difficult to know where all the buttons and levers were. Mm-hmm. We think of him running just a what we might call a straight line dictatorship, lots of tyranny, lots of fear and punishment that were what kept him in place. But what we haven't looked at very much is how Saddam Hussein, particularly after 1991, was able to manipulate the tribal rivalries in Iraq in order to keep himself in power. He had a whole network of tribal alliances that essentially kept him in power in the south and to a certain extent in the north. I mean, there's that situation was a little bit different. And how those all worked was really personal relationships, which we as outsiders simply don't have.
No, and a brilliant dose of public relations as well. I remember on my own trips into Iraq how often Iraqi television would broadcast these great celebrations of Saddam Hussein with the tribal leaders from the south. I mean, that one piece of video played over and over again, and in part, I guess, to just try and drill it in that this man was a part of the whole country. Bathsheba, let me ask you about one of the sort of overall concerns you raise in the post-war Iraq report, and that is the nature of the administration's secrecy. You're saying that there's been very little public debate so far, and so a great deal of what might happen is unknown. Now, tell me, in your view, is that because the work's not done, or there is some strategic reason in keeping that under wraps now?
Well, I think in part it's because the work is not completely done, which is sort of what we're seeing play out now. So, as Sandra was mentioning, I mean, some of the stuff is happening so quickly and maybe more quickly than they had anticipated. And so we are seeing sort of very last minute and very sort of furious efforts to get the civil administration in. And what we're also seeing is immediate problems about keeping the public safety and security in the aftermath of the conflict. So part of it, I'm not sure what the strategic decision would have been to have been keeping this secret. I think part of it is just that the plans really only started being made with any seriousness and in a lot of detail in January, which just is not a lot of time before the conflict actually started. And I think, though, what we've also been seeing a lot of is that there are still ongoing disputes about some of these issues between various parts of the U.S. government. And so that has sort of delayed getting the plans out, because I think there just hasn't been been a decision yet, and until there was, a lot of what we saw was sort of, well, the State Department wants this and the Defense Department wants this. Mm-hmm. And when you add into it the political sensitivities and the diplomatic issues that we've been dealing with, both in the lead-up to the war and then as we're also seeing now in the conversations about the post-war phase, it also makes it more difficult because every single word is parsed, every sentence is parsed and becomes that much more important.
Now, setting aside just for a second the conversation about the characters, whether or not it's Garner calling the shots or Chalabi calling the shots, I want to ask you, Bathsheba, about something that Sandra was saying earlier, and that is how narrow this window of opportunity to create a sense of trust in Iraq is. I mean, we know that there are people in Baghdad now looking up at Marines, perched on their tanks, looking down on them. That's not the sort of civil administration police force I would imagine that any kind of occupying force wants to have and have being seen in the streets.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And one of the things that we're seeing play out here is that we don't yet know exactly what the plans are for the post-war security force, although what Secretary Rumsfeld and others have said is that we hope to get troops from other countries, such as NATO, some NATO troops into Iraq to act as a peacekeeping force. We don't have that commitment yet, and we don't have those decisions made quite yet. And so the only troops on the ground are the combat forces, and it is always difficult in the post-war period to have the same troops that were rolling through the streets of Baghdad, in this case on tanks, very heavily armed, the next day be expected to do things like just keep the peace in the streets and stop looting and stop rioting.
And Sandra, let me hear you on that. Just the way that these soldiers will be seen as opposed to being seen as policemen, you know what I mean?
Well, I think the great paradox of Iraq that, again, was not considered adequately is that as fragmented as the Iraqis are, they have one unifying characteristic, and that is that they absolutely have this deep hostility to foreign occupation. They had a colonial history with the British, but it's also the idea of just these tribal people like to operate within their own group.
Almost as if that sense of patriotism lives within a larger sense of just not wanting other people in there.
That's right. It's not what, you know, we would call genuine nationalism that really helps build countries. It's a negative force which says we don't want outsiders in. And in the past, it's also been this idea of we do not want the control of Baghdad either. So here we have, you know, these American troops there. And they are going to be seen as liberators for a very short period of time, and then they're suddenly going to become foreign occupiers who all the Iraqis are going to be very hostile toward.
All right, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, when we come back, we'll hear from Michael Goldfarb, who is in Erbil at this hour and watching the war move its way into the crucial northern cities of Mosul and Kirkuk. Another flashpoint as we keep track of what's going on here. We're interested in hearing from you about the high stakes that America is involved with this occupation, plans to build an Iraqi provisional government. Is the country prepared for all the costs and all the risks? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR, National Public Radio. We're examining the pitfalls of occupation this hour. Certainly one of the areas that promises the greatest challenges in the area is northern Iraq, where Iraqi and Kurdish and Turkish interests all converge on a series of lucrative oil fields. WBUR's Michael Goldfarb is there, and he joins us with the latest news from that front.
Well, the two big cities just inside Iraqi government territory, Kirkuk and Mosul, are finally under military operations. In fact, Kirkuk, during the course of the day, has basically fallen to the U.S. Special Forces and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters. Earlier in the day, there was artillery and mortar attacks on Iraqi positions around Kirkuk. And Kirkuk is the actual oil prize of this section of the country. And at the same time that these artillery attacks began, many members of the Ba'ath Party and the Iraqi army began to slip away. Inside the city of Kirkuk, Kurdish television is reporting, the citizens there, who are mostly Kurds, began an uprising. The Peshmerga went in to support their fellow Kurds, supported by special forces, and the city has essentially fallen. The reports at the moment say up to 20,000 Kurdish Peshmerga fighters are currently in Kirkuk. In Mosul, which is close to where I am in Erbil, over the last few days, C-130 transport planes have been bringing in tanks. And so for the first time on the northern front, we're seeing real armored columns moving through northern Iraq, and they're on the way to Mosul as we speak.
This is everything that the Kurds had hoped for.
Everything, Dick, and take away the terrible friendly fire accident of last weekend. The Kurds, who have so often suffered, been in the middle or initiated their own uprising, have had, compared to the rest of the country, a fairly easy war of it. They are going in. The U.S. military is supporting them. There's a constant stream of compliments from one set of commanders to the other about the excellent cooperation between both groups of fighters. I mean, special forces calling in airstrikes, coordinating activity with Peshmerga guerrillas. The only cloud on a cloudless day here in Erbil on the horizon is the one that is floating up from Ankara in Turkey. The site of Peshmerga fighters in Kirkuk, which is the terminus of the Iraqi-Turkish oil pipeline, has people in Ankara already saying that a permanent presence of Kurdish Peshmerga in that city would be unacceptable.
But if the Kurds gain control of those northern oil fields, and you know this better than most of us, then they're going to be very reluctant to give it up. That would be the fuel for the independent state that they've been working for, and could, as you're suggesting, precipitate a whole new round of fighting if the Turks decide that that's unacceptable and they move south.
That is possible, Dick. Although, to be very clear, in the 21 days from the start of the war to the fall of the regime, the discipline exhibited by Kurdish leaders, both military and political, has been pretty extraordinary because, once it became clear that there would be no real northern front, that the American 4th Division, the U.S. Army's 4th Division, would not, you know, come in from Turkey, there was always this fear that the Peshmerga would take matters into their own hands. In fact, they haven't. And I think that my sense of the situation here on the ground is that the Turkish government is rather too nervous about the prospect of an independent Kurdistan. I think that over the last few years, and certainly since the last time you were here, Dick, the changes here for the better have been remarkable because there's been a large level of cooperation between the two main political parties here and the U.S. government. And the standard of living here is actually higher than it is in Iraq. And my guess is that they will see what happens in terms of forming an interim government before they start making noises towards independence, regardless of who controls the oil. And I'm quite clear, by the way, I'm quite clear talking to American sources here, that the U.S. is going to ensure that the oil remains if in neutral hands or in American hands.
Michael, you'll also know that one of the things Saddam Hussein did was move a great number of people from the south, Arabs, into those northern oil cities in order to dilute the Kurdish population. I guess one of the measures of how disciplined the Kurds will be number one, how well they treat those Arabs, and number two, whether or not there's the sort of looting and lawlessness that we've seen in the south of the country.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, Dick. Today, this morning, I was in a town called Mahmur, which was primarily Kurdish, and then in the fighting in 1991 at the end of the last Gulf War, when the ceasefire was drawn and the dividing line between the Kurdish Autonomous Region and Iraq was settled, Mahmur was in Iraqi government territory, and Saddam indeed brought up hundreds of Arab families into the town. They have all gone. This morning I was in Mahmur, and There were so many houses and shops simply abandoned. The Arab citizens have walked away. However, the local judge, who would have been, I suppose, one of the senior authority figures, had stayed with his family, saying that he preferred to live up in the north and that he felt much safer surrounded by his Kurdish neighbors than he did going back to Baghdad.
Michael, thanks so much for your time. We'll stay in touch.
Yes, Dick. Thank you.
Michael Goldfarb is senior correspondent with WBUR's documentary unit, Inside Out. Let me turn right back to my two guests, Bathsheba Crocker, lead author of the CSIS study published just last month, Post-War Iraq, Are We Ready? And Sandra Mackey, writer and reporter. Her new book's called The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. Sandra, why don't you start us off with your thoughts on what's happening in northern Iraq now?
Well, it's, you know, again, the Kurds have had 10 years or 12 years, actually, to more or less establish an autonomous region. It has been very interesting to watch how that's evolved because there has been enormous conflict between the PUK, which is the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, and the KDP, which is the Kurdish Democratic Party. What these two groups represent are, in a sense, they're political parties, and I would say the PUK is a more like a political party than the KDP. And they tend to represent the urban interests among the Kurds versus the traditional tribal interest among the Kurds. It's going to be very, very interesting to see how this cooperation plays out once there are really resources for the Kurds to have to start distributing among themselves. And I hope that the Kurds have matured politically, that they have seen, I would say, the errors of their ways, because in some many respects, the Kurds have been their own worst enemies. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to watch and see what happens over the next few months.
Bathsheba, where does this northern tension fit as a challenge in the plan for American occupation, in your mind?
Well, the oil factor is a really crucial one, it seems to me, with what we're seeing in the north. And I think that although it's certainly a good development that the U.S. forces together with the Peshmerga fighters have taken control of these cities from the Iraqis at this point, it's also important to remember that we don't have a lot in the way of U.S. forces up in the north yet. It sounds like from what Michael was saying that that equipment is being airlifted in. Mm-hmm. But we still have to we'll have a little bit of time before there's any significant numbers of troops up there. And again, getting back to the point of the security and political vacuum, that does allow certain people, groups, political parties, whatever, to take control, to grab authority in the absence of any other immediate authority being there now that the regime has fallen. And the oil question is going to be one of the most immediate and important questions that we face. And I think it will be very interesting to see whether Michael's prediction is correct, that the U.S. will say the oil is going to be in neutral hands or U.S. hands. What President Bush and others have been saying is that actually we're going to turn over to the Iraqis as soon as possible questions about the oil. And of course, if the Kurds have moved into these northern oil-rich cities and taken control there for some period of time, it may be difficult to walk that back once there is a decision made as to what to do with the oil. It's also going to be interesting to see what happens with the Kurdish opposition groups as we start down this road of choosing the Iraqi interim authority, because not only, as Sandra has been saying, has there been some competition and disputes between the two Kurdish opposition parties, but then among all of the opposition parties, we've seen those kinds of disputes. And as we start working with those parties together with other Iraqis from in the country, this will become a very complicated process.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Burlington, Vermont. Jared's on the line. Hi, Jared.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Can you get a little closer to the phone? You're sounding a little distant there.
I'm sorry. Is this better?
Okay.
My point was that prior to the turn of the century, the whole thing was not the Arab Peninsula all the way to the Suez was all under the Ottoman Empire. And that it was drawn and divided up, part of it during the First World War, part of it after by Versailles, and part of it by the League of Nations, lines are sort of drawn in the sand. And
Are you saying that this is the time to redraw those lines?
No, I'm not. I'm saying before we redraw lines, before we set up a provisional government in our image, best take a look at the history. Best take a look at what you're dealing with. I am afraid that we have no idea of what the history is, and without having some idea of what we're dealing with, it's kind of a recipe for disaster.
Sandra Mackey, how do you factor in what Jared points to is an absolutely crucial bit of history, because if there's any part of the world that continues to live its history, it's that part of the world.
Well, that's right. And actually, what prompted me to write my book, The Reckoning, which I started in 1998, was that Saddam Hussein is one problem that we have been very focused on, but we never focused on the Iraqi state and what a problem that is. You know, it would seem on the surface that because these groups, the Shia, the major groups, the Shia, the Sunnis, and the Kurds, tend to live in certain geographic areas to allow the country simply to fragment. Well, you know, that really doesn't make much sense because, you know, number one, you are dealing with an area that is very strategically located. I mean, when we look at Iraq, there it is between, you know, the Persian Gulf and those pipelines that are going to be coming, that are coming out of Central Asia mm-hmm. with the gas supplies and so forth. And you have to say, well, you know, you've got oil in the south, you've got oil in the north, but you don't have anything in the middle. And the other geographic factor I think we need to consider is that Iraq is also on the eastern edge of the Arab world. That is, it is an Arab country, and it's not an Arab country. And it is a very, very important transition point moving from Iran over into the Fertile Crescent. And so to you really have to deal with this area as a whole, no matter how little sense it made when it was put together. And of course, again, we have talked about over and over that we want to protect the territorial integrity of Iraq. And the reason for that is, of course, strategic reasons.
All right. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next call from Franklin, Wisconsin. Karen's on the line. Hi, Karen.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have I'd like some comments on what Bush is doing now, which is trying to appeal through the television and communicating his message to a country that where Muslim clerics perhaps could also be of a lot of value in winning the hearts and the minds of the folks there. And then in terms of the religious aspect, then, could you comment how a secular Western democracy can be implemented, particularly in light of the demographics that we're dealing with in Iraq, which is half the population is, I believe I've heard, under 16.
And Karen, can a secular democracy even be put in place? I mean, in the last 10 years, Saddam Hussein has reached out in a somewhat, you could say, practical or conniving way to the mosques as a way of providing himself with a little bit of credibility and cover. But Bathsheba, this has got to be one of the greatest puzzles for the people who are looking at some kind of transitional authority. I mean, let's just look at the story out of Baghdad this morning. The fiercest gunfight, we are told, was because U.S. soldiers wanted to search for Saddam Hussein inside a mosque, and the people there didn't want them anywhere near it.
Well, this obviously will, as you've said, be an incredibly difficult difficult aspect to this whole process. And you were also talking at the beginning of the program about what we're seeing in Basra, with the British having decided to work with the cleric there and now being told by others in the city that under no circumstances should they work with that cleric or perhaps any clerics because mm-hmm. they were all in bed with Saddam Hussein. It's obviously going to be very difficult. It's one of the immediate tasks that the U.S. civil administrators who are going in will face is also this question of which Iraqis to work with in the towns and cities throughout Iraq. And from what we've heard, one of the plans is, in fact, to look to tribal leaders and religious leaders. And, of course, it becomes very difficult to know who's telling the truth and who really is a traditional leader and who isn't, and which ones were in bed with the Ba'ath Party and which weren't. And we're also seeing some of the Ba'ath Party members and officials sort of fading into the distance. They could come back at a certain point as militia or as pockets of resistance. So these are all sort of very critical and questions that we will be facing immediately, and I don't think the task will be easy. The question of Bush appealing to the populace and whether we will, you know, what we're going to do in order to make this into a secular democracy. I mean, I think in addition to which Iraqis are we going to work with, we also have the importance of gaining the trust of Iraqis throughout the country right now, which will be also largely impacted by how quickly we can start getting humanitarian assistance into the country, which has been another problem.
Well, Sandra, does there have to be a place for the clerics in the administration of the country?
Well, I think that we should not be hysterical about clerics in government, because when you look at Iraq, you really have two groups of among the Shia. One was the groups in Karbala and Najaf, who principally were connected to Iran. This was back, early,
right.
Back in the early part of the century. And the Shia who are in the countryside are principally tribal people who are Shia not because of theology as much as that their tribal sheikh decided that they should become Shia in order to form an alliance with groups within these cities that
so there's
help.
Politics there that needs to be capitalized on. We need to wrap up here.
And you know, these are not clerics of the Khomeini type.
All right. Karen, thanks very much for that call. Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. Occupation, the puzzles, the predicaments that lie ahead, and your thoughts, your opinions. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. With me on the program this hour, Sandra Mackey. She is author of a new book, The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. I think that's the fifth or sixth book she's written about her understanding of the Middle East, has lived in Saudi Arabia a number of years and has written most of her journalistic career about that area of the world. Bathsheba Crocker is also with us. She's at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and lead author of a report that was published just last month called Post-War Iraq, Are We Ready? She was also an international fellow with the CSIS International Security Program and an author of a previous report, A Wiser Peace. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go back to the lines now. David's joining us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hello, David.
How you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
I have a question, I guess, for the guests or for anybody who can answer it. Has the administration given any consideration to the possibility that maybe democracy won't work in Iraq? I don't know enough about the history of the country to know what kind of government was in place before Saddam. But if it's something that won't work, how long are we going to stay there and try to make it work?
Well, Bathsheba, is that even one of the multiple choice questions on their list right now?
I mean, I'm sure it must be in the back of their mind somewhere. I at least think they're aware of the difficulty that we're going to face in trying to instill a democratic political culture in Iraq. But from everything I've seen, what administration officials will say is we just don't believe that it's impossible in a Muslim country or an Arab country to have a democracy. And they believe very strongly that this is what the Iraqi people want. It's what they've said they wanted, at least what the opposition groups have said the Iraqi people want, and that we can do this. But of course, the caller's point, or the caller's question, just points out that that this will be, in fact, quite a long-term commitment, and the notion that it is something that we can sort of turn around on a dime is a far-fetched one. This is going to be a long process because this country does not, in fact, have a history of democracy. So we will put in place democratic political institutions, which, with the idea that that these institutions will grow over time and that democracy, that democratic political culture, will be instilled throughout the country. But it's going to be a matter of many years.
Sandra, tell me, in your view, is it further muddied by the fact that the U.S. administration has so much at stake in seeing a democracy take root, that it might not be in a position, and I'm kind of a little bit off David's point here, but it might not be in a position to set up the type of administration which is exactly best for Iraq?
Well, I think it gets back to the earlier point about how complex the political landscape of Iraq is. And, you know, can you simply come in and say, we're going to establish a government and the people are going to elect their officials and it's going to be, you know, one person, one vote type of democracy? That's just not going to work in Iraq because you have to consider how much each of these groups feels that they must protect their own interests. And that's, as I said earlier, that you really are going to have to devise some system that is, you know, that both gives the Shia their rights as the majority, but at the same time protects minority rights. And we're also talking about the Turkmens, the Assyrians, the Armenians. I mean, there are other minority groups here that also have a stake in the system and in protecting themselves.
So it would have to be some kind of federal state where, I mean, you have to at least find some kind of construction where people have the opportunity to vote.
Yes, and I, you know, the idea of some sort of federal system is certainly appealing to the Kurds. You also have to realize that the Sunnis in the middle of the country, they feel really wedged in between the majority Shia and the Kurds in the north. Mm-hmm. And the Kurds, of all the groups, probably have more of a political structure in place than anybody else does. And I think that the chances that they can really make it work is very good. But, you know, it's how you proportion out power and, again, access to resources, because we're talking about a country that is potentially very wealthy.
Yeah.
And that's just going to, I think, you know, increase the competition between these groups for their rightful share of those resources.
Okay, David, thanks for that question. Next to Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Sorry about that. And Ann's joining us. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I had a question regarding the role of women in a democracy in Iraq. How do you see that playing out?
Who's best on that? Sandra, should that go to you or to Bathsheba? Help me with this one.
Well, I'll give a real quick answer and then turn it over to her. You know, Iraq has a tradition of being a secular state, and certainly among the urban classes, the position of women has been, you know, reasonably good. Now, in the urban areas, you also have the lower classes who are very traditional, and it's a different situation. But I don't think the women's issue is perhaps as acute as it would be in, say, someplace like Saudi Arabia.
Or even Afghanistan, I suppose.
Right. I think that's even a better example.
Is it an example? Or is it an issue that they're looking at, Bathsheba?
It is one that they will consider, and it's certainly one that they have considered. Obviously, in Afghanistan, it was a big issue, but the procedures put in place for choosing delegates, for example, to the Loya Jirga, which was the group that ended up choosing President Karzai and the transitional government form in Afghanistan, it was very carefully designed to include the participation of women. I imagine we'll see something similar here, but just drawing on Sandra's point, I mean, one of the interesting things in looking at Iraq is to see, at least in the center of the country and in the urban places, that women have actually historically and recently held quite high positions in government and are sort of peppered throughout the government ministries. And so it's not going to be as acute an issue as it was in Afghanistan.
All right, Anne, thanks for that call. Let's go to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Ben's on the line. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to your two guests talk about secular democracy and concerns about tribalism and regionalism, it occurs to me that first, I mean, as an American, I certainly favor secular democracy as the best form of government. And as an American, I certainly alert to our strategic interests in that area. However, I'm just wondering, as a matter of, I'll call it political legitimacy, how is it that we get to tell another country what form of government it will have? How is it that we get to decide whether they will remain intact as one country or be divided either in terms of independence or autonomy into other countries or regions? Given that we went in supposedly just to stop Iraq from using or exporting weapons of mass destruction,
right,
aren't we now, when we say we're going to put in our way of life, government, and values, potentially fueling the kind of Arab resentment we've been hearing about, saying, wait a minute, you're turning this into America East, and that's not what you said you were going to do.
Okay, Ben, good question. And maybe, Bathsheba, you can start with that. I mean, how do you square on one hand saying, let Iraqis run Iraq, and on the other hand saying, oh, and these are how the ways we'd like you to run it?
It's a very fine balance, so we're going to have to walk a very delicate line on this one. I think it's an excellent question. It also raises, again, the issue of getting the UN involved, because that would provide some wider legitimacy for this process than the U.S. just going in and dictating the government. Having said that, the Bush administration has been quite clear that, to the extent possible, it will be up to the Iraqis to determine the future political system and government system that they will have in that country, so that, for example, we're going to start seeing a series of meetings among the free Iraqis we were discussing earlier. And even for those meetings, which are sort of the precursor to setting up an interim government made up of Iraqis, the Bush administration has said they are not going to determine what part of, you know, what percentage of the Iraqi interim authority will be made up of Shia or Sunni or Kurd or any of the other groups in Iraq, that will be one of the things the Iraqis have to decide for themselves, even just for the purposes of these initial meetings. Now, how that will play out will be interesting, given sort of the competition and the disputes between those groups that we've already seen, and even more difficult when we add in Iraqis from inside the country to that mix. But it is a sign that the administration, I think, will, what it intends to do anyway, is set up frameworks and structures, but within those, really try to let the Iraqis battle these questions out themselves, and then that will be the beginnings of learning how a democracy works.
All right. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. 1-800-423-8255. Thanks very much for that call, Ben, to Wilmington, North Carolina now. Tommy's on the line. Hi, Tommy.
Hey. My comment would be that as perhaps the most diverse and stable country in the world today, I mean, I think we're a very diverse country. We obviously have some experience in dealing with these diversities. We had our Civil War, of course, but that was 100 years ago or more. We're still living with that to a certain extent. But, I mean, of all the countries in the world, I mean, it seems to us that our historical experience gives us a good perspective on how to pull this thing off. And if anybody can pull it off, I think we could probably do it.
Sandra, do you think that message can be delivered the way that Tommy's articulated it? I mean, the Iraqis see the men on tanks, but they will also know something about the history of America.
Well, the exiles certainly do, but I think we have to keep in mind that another of the problems we haven't touched on is that how isolated the people in Iraq have been under Saddam Hussein's regime, and particularly since 1991 with the sanctions. And the people in Iraq really don't know a lot about the outside world. You know, they have been given this propaganda year after year after year.
That America is bad and led by the devils and trying to steal all our oil and so on and so forth. That's the propaganda you mean?
Well, it's been Saddam Hussein's cult of personality, yeah. The United States is trying to take, well, as you say, take Iraq's oil and so forth. But one of the things I think we need to really think about is that, you know, the United States is a nation of immigrants, and we don't have these century-old social systems and value systems and touch marks of identity that you have in Iraq. And we very often forget that Iraq is a very young country. It's only existed since 1921, and it really hasn't had the opportunity to build up a sense of itself. And the United States certainly has a sense of self that really tends to meld people reasonably well. But I think it is a good point that just because you have a heterogeneous society does not just make the building of a democracy impossible.
Bathsheba, I wonder if you can put us back in the planning book to sort of tie up the bow on this conversation. It seems to me that this whole notion of being an occupying power, and I know it doesn't happen all the time, but it's almost like nobody ever learns from situations that have come before. Where are the lessons from Afghanistan here? Where are the lessons from the Balkans? Where, I mean, it seems like it's being made up all over again.
Well, I think that's an excellent point, and does accurately describe, for the most part, what we're seeing here. One of the problems, as we found in our work at CSIS on this post-war reconstruction issue generally, is that we don't really do a great job of learning lessons from previous situations. So every time we face one of these situations, which is beginning to be at least once a year, we sort of are learning on the spot and learning on the fly, and things look a little bit ad hoc. I mean, part of this is you do have to be flexible, and each country that we go into is very different. The set of circumstances is different. The conflict is different. The aftermath of the conflict is different, etc. At the same time, there are some generic lessons that could be learned and should be learned. Interestingly, although we see a certain lack of preparation here, and I think we'll see that playing out in a very real way on the ground over the next few weeks. The planning that was done here is actually much more than what is done normally by the U.S. government for post-war phases, and that may be because we had such a long lead-up to the war that there was more time this time. But we will still see this look like a totally new situation and one we haven't faced before.
Bathsheba, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Bathsheba Crocker is an International Affairs Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. And Sandra, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Sandra Maki is author of 5 books about the Middle East, most recently The Reckoning, Iraq, and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. Earlier in the program, we heard from Michael Goldfarb, senior correspondent with WBUR's Inside Out documentary unit. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.